the key in the lock. His voice is like contaminated engine oil floating on the surface of a river at night. A sharp stab of anxiety grips me. Is he lying to me? Something about his supine display of remorse rings false. Well, fuck you, I think. Sleep tight. Need food. I activate the ward. Blissful silence descends. The rest of the weekend is uneventful. If only I could relax and enjoy it. It's Tuesday, and pigeons released weeks ago are coming home to roost. Monday started with an all-hands meeting to introduce our four new hires to the analysts, HR, and support folks. That kind of event is always risky. Teetering on the edge of embarrassment. For quiet, gawky Billy, aka the Torch, it's his first ever job in a workplace with carpet, much less indoor plumbing and co-workers who wear suits. There's a 150% pay rise hanging over him like the sword of Damocles. What is he supposed to do to earn it? He's silently terrified, even though he has enough firepower in his right index finger to take out a main battle tank. For my part, I'm just glad that his hoodie, combats and trainers are clean enough he doesn't look as if he's walked in off a construction site. B, aka Lucy Taylor, is infinitely more mature. If by mature you mean sassy. With her dark hair gathered in pigtails, and wearing a 50s-style yellow dress with black horizontal stripes, she could pass for a hipster on speed. If hipsters had a permanent caffeine buzz and metaphorical stingers. She's excited. Energized, eager to make a difference. This poise has Billy unsurprisingly caught somewhere between fascination and terror. So he's pointedly ignoring her. Great way to start building a team. Our two other new hires aren't here yet. But I can at least show everyone their mugshots and order that they be made welcome on arrival. Speaking of which, I'd like you all to welcome Billy and Lucy to the Transhuman Police Coordination Force. They've got a steep learning curve ahead of them, and lots of training courses before they can represent the force in public, along with our two other frontline superpowers, Lollipop Bill and Captain Marvelous, who will be arriving next week. Billy and Lucy. Mary Murphy will start you on your basic orientation today and introduce you to everyone this afternoon, so you don't need to memorize their names right now. I know this is all a lot to take in at once. I suddenly realize that even though Jim's elsewhere and Sam is visiting a sick relative, there are nearly a dozen people present. But don't worry, you'll get used to it in no time. The formal introduction's done. I beat a hasty retreat into my office. There's plaster dust on the carpet, and an unpleasant oily smell in the air, courtesy of the hulking gun safe in the corner. Footnote. It arrived early last week. When I phoned Harry the horse at the new annex, and he said it couldn't be fitted before next month, I snarled semi-politely and referred him to the senior auditor. It's amazing what taking God's name in vain can accomplish, when you've got God on speed dial and he considers your needs to be an urgent priority. I check my chair carefully for plaster dust before I sit down. I'm wearing my smart suit today, in anticipation of spending the afternoon at a home office briefing session, and I'm about to bury myself in prep for the anticipated grilling on anything we can contribute to the Freudstein problem. When Ramona motors in. "Hi, Mo," she says. "I've got a surprise for you." "What kind?" I ask cautiously. "Nothing bad." She smiles gleefully as she whirs forward, holding up a USB key. "What's that?" "First cut at a promo video. Want to watch it together?" I suppress my first reflexive response, a groan. Force a smile. And say, "Can do." Then I shove the memory stick into the front of my newly chained to the desk PC. We've recently acquired new software that locks everything down. Only lets data in, not out, when you plug in a dongle, and refuses to run software that hasn't been installed and authorized centrally by IT support. In my opinion, and everyone else's, it turns our PCs into single-function boat anchors. But 2 months and 10 employees on, our organizational threat surface has expanded until it's too dangerous for us to risk laptops. Also, we now have to play by civil service regs, not laundry rules. Let's see what they've come up with. Move over. I shove my chair sideways to make room for Ramona. There is indeed a movie file on the stick. I double-click, wait for the obligatory 3 virus scanners to do their stuff, then sit back while the video player fills the screen with the first thing the organizational PR agency's collective subconscious have come up with. Start. Animation showreel. The scene. A boringly normal-looking suburban street in any town, England. Dogs bark. Children shout. A delivery van drives slowly past. Cut to. A different street. More densely urban. Houses on one side, a big new charter school campus on the other. Uniformed kids hang around outside the gates and in the playground. Voice over. Keeping our schools and homes safe. Pan right. A street corner adjacent to the school. Just round the corner, past more buildings, the camera zooms in to frame a man in a lime green pervert suit and cloak, crouching in front of a house. He brandishes a teddy bear at the camera. Pervert suit. Or, I am nonce boy. I hang out on street corners near schools and hypnotise your kids. Who knows what hideous perversions I fantasize about perpetrating on their smooth underage flesh, what nightmarish pedo-bear-related fantasies I intend to corrupt their innocent little souls with. Zoom out. A posse of superheroes are racing down the side street towards Pervert Suit. Superhero 1. It's Nonce Boy! Get him! Superhero 2. On my way! Superhero 3. Female. Flying scissor kick! Operogi jump! They fight. Cut to Nonce Boy lying prone on the pavement with his hands and feet hog-tied in elaborate Japanese rope bondage style. The superheroes stand over him. He grins horribly at the camera. Nonce Boy. They're making a big mistake. Cut to a police interview room. 2 inspectors are cross-examining Nonce Boy. Inspector 1.
And what exactly did Superhero 1 say?
Nonce Boy.
I heard him distinctly say, it's Nonce Boy, get him! Then he attacked me without provocation.
Inspector 2.
Are you denying your previous? You've done time for hideous crimes of hideousness. He obviously thought you were about to get up to your old tricks again.
Nonce Boy.
Nevertheless, I has my human rights, including the right not to be beaten up by random vigilantes.
Confidingly.
And there's more.
Inspector 1.
What else?
Nonce Boy.
Superhero 3 used her operogi jump on me. That's sexual assault, that is.
Cut 2. A police briefing room with the 2 inspectors. Inspector 2.
It's no good. He's got us banged to rights.
Inspector 1.
We can't let him go. He's a pervert.
Inspector 2.
But he's right about one thing. The superheroes who took him down are vigilantes. They didn't observe due process. They didn't identify a suspect in the process of committing or preparing a crime. They aren't sworn officers of the law like you and me. They use dubious or outright illegal methods, and they inadvertently handed his defense a watertight case. In fact, they'll be lucky if he doesn't sue them.
Inspector 1.
All we can do is let him go and hope he falls downstairs on his way out of the cell block.
Inspector 2.
And this is a 1-story-high police station, so that's not terribly likely.
Inspector 1 addresses the camera.
So, Nonce Boy walks free, all because those superheroes
acted like idiots.
Zoom in. Inspector One. Inspector One.
Want to be a superhero? Don't be like these numpties. Join up with TPCF. Get wise. Get trained. Get your villain.
Fade to. Home Office logo. Transhuman Policy Coordination Force contact information.
Well, what do you think?
I think that was pretty good, actually. It compared favorably with Plan 9 from Outer Space. 3 Rotten Tomatoes?
I was thinking surf Nazis must die.
Actually, if they ham it up a bit more, see if they turn the dial from 9 to 11 and switch from animation to human actors, might hit Adam West Batman values of kitsch.
Who knows? We might be on course to be the first government agency to win a Golden Oyster Award.
But it got the key points across, didn't it? I know it's meant to be funny, but there's a fine line between being laughed with and being laughed at. If we go public with this, we'll be a laughingstock.
So, that's a no, Mo.
Remember the search for the homesick sense of humour? They had to ground the rescue choppers for maintenance checks. They'd been airborne so long. If we take this to the Home Office, someone's going to have to explain all the jokes to her, and I don't want that someone to be me. I'm pretty sure she's got Medusa DNA.
Pause.
Unless we make it look like a leak. What if we let it show up on YouTube with a disclaimer saying it's an unreleased rough treatment?
You mean it's kitsch enough it might just go viral?
But we could disclaim it if it backfires.
Holy Batman, that's brilliant, Mo.
Who knows? It's a long shot. But it just might work.
Chapter 16. Democracy in Action. The amusement afforded me by the first of our promo video treatments is short-lived, because after a lunchtime raid on Pret-a-Manger, I have to return to Marsham Street and the Home Office for the long-dreaded grilling about, well, everything. This session is somewhat smaller than the previous one, but it will be chaired by the Right Honourable Jessica Green herself. Luckily, Jim is coming along, fancy uniform and all, so I'm not the only sacrificial rodent entering the snake pit. But I confess to feeling some trepidation, almost enough to make me dial in the combination on my safe and remove Lecter. But not quite. If it's a really hostile session and I get upset, there is a very remote chance that I will undergo a stress reaction, and if Lecter is present, the potential for certain defensive reflexes to cut in is also present, and it would be a very bad idea to eat the soul of the fourth-ranking minister in the cabinet, even though some of her harsher detractors would laugh in disbelief at the very idea that she has a soul in the first place. I meet Jim in the concourse outside. He looks the very model of a modern police major general.
Afternoon, Mo. How do you want to play this?
I shrug. I think we should be blunt but honest. Aside from operational workup, our biggest priority is the search for Freudstein. Messages. We are working on building a profile of him, but we are handicapped by a lack of resources and information. Freudstein is a canny opponent, and he is clearly attempting to manipulate us. We intend to get inside his decision loop and outmaneuver him. But so far we have very little data upon which to build a predictive model of his activities, because they are cunningly arranged to be maximally flashy, but effectively random. Jim nods, but looks withdrawn.
She's not going to like that.
No, but what else? The door opens, and a junior undersecretary beckons us forward.
Remember, it's not all about Freudstein.
Jim warns me quietly, and then we go in. This conference room has natural light, courtesy of a row of high windows opposite the doorway. There's a U-shaped set of tables for the Home Secretary and her staff, and a table set across the end for people giving evidence or testimony or confessions. That would be us, I guess, from the semicircle of a dozen faces opposite. Mrs. Green sits at the far end of the U, chatting affably to a senior departmental secretary to her right. Our usher directs us to the seats in the hotspot, then closes the door, and we're off.
Dr. O'Brien, it has been nearly 8 weeks since the individual or group identifying themselves as Professor Freudstein first came to our attention. Why haven't you caught him, or her?
Mrs. Green is as direct and friendly as the business end of a machine gun, but it's not personal. And I know how to handle this sort of interrogation. Years of performing in front of the auditors have hardened me. With all due respect, one might ask why the security guards at the Bank of England, SCO-19 at the British Library on Euston Road, or the civil nuclear police at Sellafield all failed to capture him. I don't want to play the blame game, but they were on site during his previous appearances. My unit was not. And furthermore, we're still working up towards an operational capability which we have not yet achieved. Let me emphasize that. We're not fully operational yet. We're still recruiting and training personnel. The real problem with Freudstein is that we're not dealing with a normal criminal here. As I said, I don't want to play the blame game. Freudstein doesn't fit any of the threat profiles those forces are designed to deal with. In fact, from the planning he's demonstrated so far, he's operating more at the level of a hostile government agency rather than a criminal gang or terrorist cell. He, or they, I think there's a very high probability that we're dealing with an organization here, have access to trained special forces people, automatic weapons, helicopters, vehicles, and inside intelligence on some of the nation's most tightly guarded facilities. That's before we mention enough plutonium to credibly threaten us with multiple nuclear weapons. What we don't have is any kind of clue about his identity, real or purported, nor do we know what he wants. Although, I fail to say aloud, there's probably a clue buried in what he stole from the library. If only we knew what he was really after and what were the decoy thefts. Freudstein is our number one priority. And if we develop a source, or if a sister agency can give us a lead in time to deploy, we will engage him immediately. My analysts are currently creating a database of all known superpowers in the UK, and we are developing a profile for Freudstein and looking for possible leads on his real-world identity, if he is indeed a Five Sigma evil genius. But we're still dependent on leads from other forces. Nobody saw fit to inform us of the Sellafield incident until 3 days after it took place. That's typical of the level of cooperation we're currently getting. Again, I do not want to attribute any blame for this. In many cases, the forces concerned don't even officially know we exist, much less have a set of criteria for referring incidents to us. But it's not helping us do our job. Why not? Mrs. Green is typically blunt. Because we were only formally established as a police force by order in Privy Council 4 weeks ago. And while we've sent out briefing packs to all the other forces, they're still working their way through the system. Jim and I briefed as many ACPO chiefs as we could reach at their summit last week. But it takes time for new information to get from the head office down to the feet on the beat. Green shares a brief whispered exchange with the woman on her left, a parliamentary private secretary, if my nose serves me right. An MP on the first rung of the ladder to ministerial rank, essentially a political gopher assigned to the Home Sec. Then, turns back to me.
Dr. O'Brien, I notice a pronounced defensiveness in your responses and a lack of proactive engagement with your primary objectives.
Her eyes narrow.
You've been up and running for 8 weeks. What have you accomplished?
Oh, shit. I think on my feet. Let me start from the top. I've assembled a core management team of experienced superpowers, able to provide an austere, basic response in event of a notified incident while our operational team is in training. We were active in time to be on site during the Euston robbery. We subsequently established transport and logistic capabilities that support deployment anywhere in the UK, and have already deployed operationally in response to a support call from Greater Manchester Police. Please don't ask how it went. We have created an analysis department, which is, as I said, currently working up a database of all known superpowers in the UK of 3 Sigma or higher capability. We have established liaison protocols with ACPO and are in the process of bringing all the territorial forces up to speed. We have recruited, after enhanced CRB checks and interviews, a core superpower team, suitable for deployment with backup and oversight from the management team once they are fully trained. We are undergoing intensive training in police procedures and operations because it's necessary for our superhero team to be sworn in officers of the law. I should note that training for a probationary constable is normally 2 years, but we're working with Hendon to get them through the essentials in less than 6 months. We've been working with a Home Office approved PR organisation to produce a range of public information materials in support of our core function of diverting potential vigilantes into working within a lawful framework. Mrs. Green is rubbing her forehead. Am I giving her a headache? Oh dear. Dr. O'Brien, she says, icily polite. This is all very well, but it's not helping to catch Freudstein. In case you hadn't noticed, this country is facing a general election in 9 months' time. Freudstein is currently setting the paranormal policing agenda by default, and if your organisation hasn't caught him by then, it isn't going to exist. You might not have been paying attention, but my right honourable opponent, the Shadow Home Secretary, is making hay with the superpower issue. He's publicly saying that your force is a boondoggle, and that when he's in my office, he will start with a blank sheet review. And I should remind you that the only reason Freudstein's escapades are not yet public knowledge is because Freudstein hasn't publicised them. And we have managed to keep the lid on everything, except the British Library robbery, due to the potential for public panic. But the blackout isn't going to last forever, and your failure to apprehend Freudstein could become the sensational lead story across all media at any moment. If that happens, it will make this government look bad. I need a concrete achievement to point to within the next month. Get me one. She raises a hand. Without shooting up any more mosques? Her tone is dry enough to parch the Sahara. Her gaze slides away from me to look at Jim. Chief Superintendent, what is the state of readiness of the TPC force in terms of the police service readiness criteria? Jim doesn't miss a beat. Working up, ma'am. That is to say, it's simply not fully operational yet, and won't be for at least 4 months, as my director said. Our key bottleneck is that there is only one identified 3 Sigma Plus police officer in the country, and he's already working for TPCF. Everyone else has to pass through basic training. TPCF is actually ahead of where I would expect a new organisation to be at this early stage. Its lean staffing level and austere budget mean there's no room for feather bedding, and it's agile and responsive. Also, we've been able to import management with existing experience of dealing with extraordinary threats from the MOD. The downside of that stance is that it's brittle. We're reliant on highly skilled individuals rather than functioning as a resilient organisation. Dr. O'Brien is addressing this, but, as she noted, it will take time. Mrs. Green nods. I keep a poker face as I realise that she'll accept it coming from a man in a uniform, but not from a woman. She fixes Jim with the unblinking basilisk stare she learned from her idol, the Iron Lady. I seem to be beneath her notice. Get me something. Anything newsworthy and positive will do at a pinch,
but what I really want is Freudstein's hide. I expect weekly updates in the meantime.
We are dismissed. The pit bull releases its chew toy, and we limp away to nurse our wounds. I'm going to fast forward past the inevitable shockwaves that fan out from my collision with Mrs. Green. If you've ever been carpeted by the boss and found wanting, you know how it goes. Let's just say that I spend the rest of the day, and early evening, in a council of war with the entire executive team, being me, Jim, Mary, Ramona, and, by special invitation, Dr. Armstrong himself, while we hammer out a highly unofficial hit list and a bunch of itemized deliverables that might meet the Home Sec's political requirements rather than our official and bewilderingly useless terms of reference. There is no point in prioritizing doing your job when your organization faces being defunded in less than 3 months' time if you don't do something else. You do what's necessary in order to ensure your organization survives, then you get back to work. This is how the iron law of bureaucracy installs itself at the heart of an institution. Most of the activities of any bureaucracy are devoted not to the organization's ostensible goals, but to ensuring that the organization survives. Because if they aren't, the bureaucracy has a life expectancy measured in days before some idiot decision maker decides that if it's no use to them, they can make political hay by destroying it. It's no consolation that sometime later someone will realize that an organization was needed to carry out the original organization's task, so a replacement is created. You still lost your job, and the task went undone. The only sure way forward is to build an agency that looks to its own survival before it looks to its mission statement. Just another example of evolution in action. When we break up around 7, I unmute my phone and check for messages. There's a text from Bob.
Mind if I drop round this evening? Need to collect some stuff.
My heart bumps up against my breastbone.
Sure,
I text back. He sent it a couple of hours ago. I didn't know he was even in town this week. Last time I heard from him, he was in Western Australia, visiting a very peculiar First Nations site in the outback. I collect my instrument case and head home, bone-tired and somewhat depressed. When I get there, the hall light is shining through the window above the porch. As I didn't leave it switched on, I assume that means Bob's home. So I unlock the door, check the alarm, it's switched off, and go inside. Bob, I call.
Here,
the reply comes from upstairs. I close the door and open the safe in the understairs cupboard and shove Lecter inside. But I do not lock it. Not just yet. I head for the kitchen, where I smell something delicious in the convection oven and see the table is laid for two. A flash of gratitude is followed by a stab of resentment. Then a moment of self-interrogation. Why am I resentful of my husband for making assumptions about my desire to dine with him? I shake my head, then go to the cupboard and haul out the cafetiere and the jar of decaf. A few seconds later, I hear Bob's footsteps on the stairs. He gets as far as the kitchen doorway, then stops.
Who died?
He asks, looking me up and down.
My career, if I'm not lucky.
I pour hot water over the coffee grounds. We were ambushed by the Home Secretary this afternoon. Be a dear and keep an eye on this while I change.
Sure.
He takes over while I head upstairs and replace my suit in its carrier, and pull on jeans and a t-shirt. Wearing office formal at home is too much like surrendering to the job. And it was making Bob uncomfortable. He's in his usual, which this decade is combat pants and casual shirt. I find him downstairs in the kitchen, stabbing a roast chicken to death with a meat thermometer.
You could have mentioned you had dinner plans,
I chide.
Sorry, I didn't think you...
Double take. You have alternatives?
Yes. I sit down. Ramona and Mary ganged up on me, so I'm taking 3 nights a week off. Going to the opera, eating out with co-workers, anything at all, really. Just as long as it stops me burning the candle at both ends every day.
Oh, well, that sounds like a good idea.
He nods ruefully.
Next time, I'll check in advance.
Sorry, I should have warned you. Apologies are the keystone of an enduring relationship. Failing to apologize for mistakes, or getting onto a treadmill of belittling insults, is a bad warning sign. So far we've avoided it, but I thought you were in Australia this week.
That was last week.
I rummage in the wine rack while he talks.
You wouldn't believe how many sites Angleton worked at during his career. Even if he only left behind one a year that needs checking out. If it takes me an average of a week to handle each of them, I'll be running around with my tail on fire for the next 18 months. Week before last, it was the sealed collection of a library in Cardiff that held the foul papers of a guy who wrote mathematical puzzle books in the '60s. It's got all the stuff Angleton made him leave out of the published editions. He was an ex-Bletchley Park analyst. Nothing to do with our mob, but it had to be inspected. Angleton didn't confiscate his notes. He just put the frighteners on him and told him not to do it again. So now I have to check them out, and either confiscate them and fend off the angry librarians, or write a memo explaining why potentially hazardous papers are lying around in a library we don't control. And last week, I had to go check the clean-up on an Aboriginal site in Western Australia, 200 miles east of Perth, south of the big mining complex. Angleton got all over the map. I plant a bottle of Sauvignon Blanc on the table. It's from a New Zealand vineyard. Extravagant. But I've got my husband back for the evening, so what the hell. I attack the screw cap and pour 2 glasses.
How long are you in town for?
I ask. I've got 3 days, mostly for filing reports and catch-up meetings. Then they're sending me to Leeds for a week to poke around a proposed new headquarters site for buried hazards.
He shudders.
That's why I'm raiding my side of the wardrobe. What are we going to do?
Eat, I say. It comes out sounding like either a promise or a threat or something.
To tell the truth, I have no idea what we're going to do. Or even if we're still a wee.
Bob dishes up slices of roast chicken breast and drumstick, roast potatoes, carrots, and swede on the side. For all that it comes in supermarket prepacks, it's welcome. We eat in companionable silence for a while.
You've got a lot of travel going on, I say eventually.
But when things quieten down, do you want to see if we can make things work again?
Bob chews mechanically, eyes staring right through me. Man boy, thoughtful. He swallows.
I don't know if that's even possible anymore. Go look under the stairs.
Suddenly he looks round.
Where's your violin?
Go look under the stairs.
He stands and walks through into the hall. A minute later he comes back and sits down again. Then takes a mouthful of wine.
Is that what I think it is?
Yes. I nerve myself for the next step.
It's warded, Bob.
The violin lives there.
For the time being.
He puts his glass down.
You're trying to give it up?
He sounds appalled and hopeful all at the same time. The words come in a rush.
It's too strong for me, Bob. It's getting more powerful all the time, and I'm getting older, and there's going to come a time when I can't control it anymore. Michael, the SE, says I'm now the second longest carrier it's ever had. We're looking for someone new, someone at Cant Renfield. But if we can't find someone to replace me, it's going to have to go back in the inactive inventory.
He stares at me, clearly surprised.
What changed, love?
You did.
I did.
I grab my glass and take a gulp of wine and then set it down hastily because my hands are shaking.
If you can
can do something. I'll meet you halfway. I don't know if it's a promise or a plea, but either way, I mean it.
He takes a deep breath.
I can't give up the Eater of Souls, Mo. Not don't want to, I mean, I can't.
Can you make it safe? I ask. I mean, safe enough to be around me without...
He stands and walks around the table. I stand, lean against him, let him hug me.
I really need to talk to someone about applied containment theory, he says, when I get time.
Which would be a diplomatic way of saying no.
You're very busy, I tell him, trying not to sound as broken as I feel.
I'm sorry, he says, letting go of me, he repeats. When I get time.
We've got all the time in the world.
I sniff, determined not to get teary.
I don't think so.
He looks at me anxious and needy. We make a dismal pairing, barely treading water on our own, so weighed down by our personalized curses, that we're each looking to the other as a life raft.
It's been well over a month already.
Please don't let this become the new normal, Mo.
Please?
But all I can do is mutely shake my head. It's not up to me anymore. I've given up a lot to be here. If Bob can't meet me halfway, I don't see what possible future we've got. On Friday morning, I go to my weekly with Dr. Armstrong. I tell him about last Saturday's dream and my subsequent dealings with my instrument.
That's a rather worrying development,
he says after I wind down. The violin intruding in my dreams? Do you think it's time for me to...
No, you're still perfectly able to control him if you set your mind to it. I meant the location.
What? The ruined city?
The King in Yellow.
The SA closes his eyes for a few seconds.
I haven't heard that name in a while. It's disturbing.
What is it? I did some digging, of course. There's a thick file on it in the stacks. But I didn't have time to trudge round to Danzy House and sign myself in for an afternoon of reading dusty archives. I'm too busy fighting administrative fires. I told the analysts to follow it up for me, along with all the other manuscripts Freudstein stole, and it's somewhere in their work queue. The SA opens his eyes.
Carcosa is one of the legendary lost cities, or rather a legendary lost Neolithic civilization. Nearly pre-agricultural. Drowned, like Doggerland, and the great cities of the Nile Delta and the Arabian Gulf, when the sea levels rose after the last ice age. They had elaborate court rituals centered around the worship of the King in Yellow. Subsequently, the foundational material for some not inconsiderable occultist fufurol in the late 19th century. It's a rite of binding, Dominique. Not unlike the ritual that certain meddling fools, who should have known better, tried to use to bind the Eater of Souls a couple of years ago.
His unblinking stare makes me feel very small.
They wrote an opera around one of the invocations, one of the solos, I do not know which. It's too dangerous to read the score. Installs a very small execution loop in the auditory cortex of anyone who hears it. If warded, one is safe. But if not, well, the first invocation anyone feeds you starts executing on your brain. Not nice. Carcosa is lost, and it is widely believed that it is lost because the King in Yellow bound his subjects in that manner, and unintentionally carried them all to a hell of his own conception, or fed them to a god of his own devising or some such.
That particular manuscript was part of the British Library heist. I don't like where this train of thought is going. The SA turns his lizard-heavy gaze on me for a moment.
Do you suppose it was Freudstein's real target?
It would make sense. played on a non-occult instrument, the loop would just be an earworm. A short melody, very hard to dislodge from one's head. But played on a device able to perform polydimensional chromatic transforms, it'd leave the audience vulnerable to demonic possession by the first trivial feeder to come along. But they'd need something like my instrument to install the loop.
Yes.
Dr. Armstrong is thoughtful.
There are certain disturbing rumors about the reason Dr. Mabuza commissioned the white violins. Rumors along those lines.
Mabuza? He was a man of whom many stories are told. None of them good. But surely he didn't actually stage a performance of The King in Yellow.
I don't believe he had the opportunity to do so. Then all known copies of the score were destroyed during the war, or collected by institutions that were, shall we say, uninterested in sponsoring a performance.
It'd be grossly irresponsible to play it without working a protective ward into the refrain. My phone rings. Before I entered his office, I set it to do not disturb. Only a very short list of people can get through.
Excuse me,
I say. The SA swallows whatever he was going to say.
Certainly,
he says, slightly stiffly, as I pull the smartphone out.
Ah, it's important,
I tell him as I glance at the screen.
O'Brien here. Speak.
Mo?
It's Mary.
We have an incident call out.
Where?
Downing Street. It's the mandate.
She fills me in quickly. He's somehow penetrated the security cordon, and is visiting the government chief whip for tea and a chat in that worthy's official residence. What he didn't reckon with was the face recognition software running on the computers fed by the CCTV cameras around Whitehall. He can beguile a human watcher, but not a database system. I get hot and cold and shivery with adrenaline, reflexively reaching for a violin case that isn't at my feet.
How long has he been there?
I ask.
Only 10 minutes so far,
Mary says eagerly.
We can get there if we hurry. Jim's in the office with Torch and Bee.
Okay. Tell them to go ahead and deploy around the area. Don't wait for me. Don't let the mandate leave the scene, but don't interfere with them until I give the go-ahead. I'm coming back to the office to... No, scrub that. Mary, you know what's in the safe in my office?
Yes.
She doesn't sound happy. Tell Ramona to open the safe and bring the violin in its case, then deploy. I'll give her the combination over the phone. If there's any trouble, or if it tries to resist, don't bother. I'll swing by the office to collect it myself. Main thing is, I want everyone and the violin on deployment. I'll meet you there directly. Can you do that?
Let me get this straight. You're deploying without your...
No. I'm relying on security clear personnel to bring it to me. I'll collect it at the incident scene. You, Ramona, and Jim are all aware of its capabilities. I trust you know better than to mess with it. She laughs, slightly shaky.
No shit. It's sunny outside.
So go his white mask. The Home Secretary wants a show? Let's give her one.
Yes, Mo.
I end the call. The SA is watching me patiently.
Yes?
He asks. It's the mandate, I tell him. He's gone too far this time. I've got to go.
I'm coming with you,
he says, unfolding himself from his chair.
You said it's happening at the Chief Whip's residence, didn't you?
He rummages in his desk drawer and pulls out a bunch of ancient-looking keys.
Yes. Follow me.
He walks towards the curtained windows at the far end of his office. I stand and follow him, and he pulls back one of the ceiling-to-floor drapes at the side to reveal a narrow wooden casement, panelled, in which is set a keyhole.
Now, let me see.
He works his way around the bunch of keys until he finds one to his liking. He inserts it in the keyhole, turns it, and the casement hinges open like a very narrow doorway. Beyond lies utter darkness.
"Follow me,"
he repeats, and slips sideways into the night. I take a deep breath. "Where does this thing go?" I ask, tiptoeing after him.
"Sideways."
I can feel a smooth surface in front of my nose, and there's another wall behind me. It's so narrow, I have to turn sideways, hoping I won't get stuck. The air is cool and fresh, and for some reason, I know in my guts that there's no ceiling overhead. Just an infinite expanse of not sky. I glance over my left shoulder and see the rectangular column of light from the SA's office dwindling with each crab-wise shuffle.
"Not far now,"
he reassures me.
"What is this?"
I ask.
"You know about the ley lines and bike paths? The shadow roads aren't so different. Think of it as the institutional equivalent of hotel space."
He's clearly been listening to Bob too much.
"So, we're taking an extra-dimensional shortcut."
I don't want to think about it.
"Extra-dimensional geodesics are wonderful, until you run into someone or something else that's coming the other way. Bob once ran into some shotgun-toting cultists on a shortcut. It's why he has a 10-centimeter-long scar on his upper right arm. He got off lightly, though. Not all the users of such routes are human. Sometimes, someone you know uses one to save a little time, and you never see them again." I shudder and hurry after the SA's receding shoulder. I can just see a twilight rectangle beyond him. Most democracies have legislatures that meet in some sort of a parliament or senate building. The UK's House of Commons meets in the Palace of Westminster, a Gothic pile on the banks of the Thames, near the middle of the cluster of neoclassical government offices, known collectively as Whitehall. The Palace of Westminster isn't as old as it looks. The original burned down by accident in the 1830s, and this one is a replacement. It also got rebuilt in the 1940s, after it burned down for entirely non-accidental reasons. About a third of a kilometre away from Parliament, there's an unassuming little stretch of road called Downing Street, lined with 18th-century townhouses that have gradually been hollowed out and turned into a warren of offices and residences for the three highest politicians in the government: the Prime Minister, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, and the one nobody's ever heard of, the Chief Whip. The Chief Whip is the Prime Minister's personal representative to individual MPs, telling them how they are expected to vote. And to give you some idea of how important the Chief Whip is in the British parliamentary system of government, that worthy lives at number 9 Downing Street, next door to the Prime Minister. While my boss, the Home Secretary, as number 4 on the totem pole, doesn't rate a residence on the street. The SA steps out of a panel in the wall of a side corridor and into a marble-floored entrance lobby. I follow on his heels as he marches straight towards the front door, and I hurry to catch up with him.
"Where are we?" I ask.
"Foreign and Commonwealth Office."
There are metal turnstiles and a security barrier ahead. He nods affably at the guard and slips through. I follow him, doing my best to look as if I belong here. We're both dressed for the part, which helps. The SA in dark grey pinstripe, and me in a black trouser suit. Out on the street, my phone vibrates. It's Mary.
"Mo here. I'm with the SA on King Charles Street at the FCO building. Where are you?"
"We're northbound on Whitehall, just pulling over beside the entrance to Downing Street. Ramona's putting the flashes on."
"Okay, we'll be with you in 2 minutes.
I hang up and tug the SA's sleeve.
"They're at the east entrance, round the block."
"Poor timing on my part,"
he says tightly, quickening his pace. Downing Street is not open to the public. There are anti-vehicle defences and electrically operated gates at either end, not to mention armed officers from the Diplomatic Protection Group. You do not park within spitting distance of those gates unless you're the police and it's an emergency. Luckily, we are the police, technically. And it is an emergency, even if they don't know it yet. Also, my people have a uniformed chief superintendent to wave at the guards, but it's still going to be a little bit tense. When Dr. Armstrong and I come round the corner, we see Jim standing beside the van, head to head with a uniformed inspector from SO17. Ramona's watery chariot has sprouted high-vis markings and a strobing light bar. A red DPG car has drawn up behind the van and its officers are standing alongside. But they're not pointing their assault rifles at anyone in particular yet. I take this to be a good omen. We walk up towards the cluster, and I pull my warrant card in readiness. But the ASA beats me to the punch. As an armed officer moves to intercept, he gives the man a saintly smile and says,
"I'm with him,"
nodding at Jim. The constable staggers slightly, then recovers and steps aside. "Sorry," I say as we shoulder past, "transhuman force." Jim seems to be having a little problem with the officer in charge of the Downing Street watch.
"We haven't been notified of any problem. You won't be. A Four Sigma supervillain has gained access to the Chief Whip's office. Anyone capable of calling for help has already been disabled."
There is a whir from the direction of the van. Ramona is lowering herself from a side door using some sort of wheelchair lift. "Dr. O'Brien," she calls. I join her, leaving the SA to assist Jim in giving the creditably tenacious inspector a backgrounder. "Thanks," I say, as she hands me my instrument case. Is it my imagination or is Lecter unusually quiet? I walk back over, just in time to hear the SA calmly deliver what should be the definitive smackdown.
"The gentleman who the Chief Whip is currently playing involuntary host to walked right in because your men were unable to see him. Luckily, his ability to cloud minds is not so effective on CCTV cameras. Why don't you ask the control room for confirmation?"
Dr. Armstrong smiles his saintly but subtly terrifying smile, then speaks, head tilted to one side as if he's listening to an invisible earpiece.
"It is now 11:58. Ask them to confirm that at 11:43, a gentleman in a three-piece suit and a bowler hat walked up to the gate and was admitted, then proceeded to the door of number 9, where he was also admitted by the officers on door duty. That's our man." "But that's impossible," begins the inspector,
as I notice a blur of motion behind him. It's B. She jumps right over the 2-meter-high spiky steel gate, then flashes along the street, covering the distance to the Chief Whip's front door, in under a second.
"You appear to have another intruder," Jim tells the inspector. "Good thing this one's a trainee constable, isn't it?"
"Back off!"
The inspector is so focused on the threat under his nose that he doesn't take his eyes off Jim, even though the Diplomatic Protection Group constables on the other side of the barrier are making a beeline for... "Can we leave this for later?" I butt in, doing my best to be visible. "We have to apprehend the mandate immediately." I hold out my warrant card in front of the inspector's nose and shove every gram of willpower I've got into it. He recoils in alarm. I don't dare look away from him. If my suspicion about what's happening to me is right, it's quite possible that if I break eye contact, he'll suddenly forget I'm even standing in front of him. It's always more pronounced when I'm stressed. People seem to stop being able to see me, as if I'm not just socially invisible. "Torch, I want you to trip the fire alarms in number 9 just as soon as you see B's in position. Try not to set the building alight. It's grade 1 listed, and there are people inside. Jim, Ramona, get those officers to safety if the mandate kicks off. I'll cover if it turns hairy." Mary is hiding in the van, but I can't blame her. It's a bit bright out here today. I heft my violin case, finger on the quick release button, and wish I'd had time to pick up some noise-cancelling headphones to hook into Lecter's preamp. They degrade the sound quality, but given who we're up against.
You can't!
The inspector stutters.
I'm impressed. He has real willpower.
You'll answer to the Home Secretary.
I certainly hope so. Now let us in, otherwise I promise you that you'll be the one who's up in front of professional standards tomorrow. A thin plume of white smoke begins to trickle from an attic window at number 9.
Oops!
Someone says aloud. An alarm siren keens. In the street, 4 or 5 officers are somehow tying themselves in knots. B let them get just close enough to think that they'd got her. Did the "I'm just a petite and harmless girl" thing to avoid provoking a restraint hold. Then, before they can get the cuffs on, she's behind them, in front of them, performing cartwheels in the street. Then she vanishes, just as the door to number 9 opens and everybody inside begins crowding out. Inspector Diligent talks urgently into his airwave. The Downing Street gate draws back, and the Keystone Cop's performance changes to something more sinister, as officers dash for cover and bring weapons to bear on the doorway. Men and women stumble around in front of the number 10 railings. They don't look as if they've left the office due to a fire alarm. They look dazed and confused, as if they've awakened from a disturbing dream to find that the dream was real. There's a blur of motion, and suddenly one of them sprouts a black cloth hood and takes a dive, feet swept out from under him. A moment later, B is sitting triumphantly on his back, locking handcuffs around his wrists. He twitches and tries to say something. Instead of listening, she pulls out a taser and zaps him in the arse. Jim, the SA, and I move forward into the crowd of evacuees. A very distinguished-looking senior politician nearly runs headlong into me as I sling my violin case over my shoulder.
"You can't arrest him!" he's shouting at Jim. "He's going to be our next Prime Minister! He's going to save the party!"
I look the Chief Whip in the eye. "You have got to be kidding me." He doesn't seem to hear me. I reach into my handbag and grab the spare heavy-duty ward bracelet. "Wear this. You'll feel better."
"But you can't!"
He's still raving as I slither past him. The mandate is having his rights read to him by a very smug-looking Chief Superintendent Grey. There's chaos on all sides. But I put my hand on Bee's shoulder and lean close to her ear. She tenses as I say, "Come with me. Don't say anything."
"All right. Dr. O'Brien?
Over here." I lead her away from the throng of confused staffers and agitated cops.
"Did he... Boss, I can't see you."
I draw a deep, shuddering breath. "Okay, so it's really happening to me. Never mind that right now. I was just going to say good job. And now, let's get you out of here before those nice officers from SO17 remember you and realize that you're still missing."
"Thanks."
B is still buzzing with adrenaline. I guide her towards the front gate.
"How are you doing this, boss? I didn't know you had a superpower."
I force myself to keep going. "Neither did I, B. But it seems to work. And if it works, don't knock it." Catching the mandate red-handed in the act of trying to suborn one of the Home Secretary's most senior colleagues is about the best possible way to end a week that began with the Home Sec effectively demanding that we prove our worth or be shut down. But it's no cause for complacency. The good news is, we've nailed the mandate. He's going to be charged with aggravated trespass, abduction of the Chief Whip, and attempted electoral fraud. He'll get his vote all right, but it's going to come from 12 jurors. The count is going to be read out to him over a CCTV link from a courtroom, and he's going to win a seat in a high-security prison cell, not Parliament. The bad news is that half the afternoon is soaked up by all the paperwork involved in wrapping up the incident, including the necessary handling guidelines once we've booked him into the secure lockup at Belgravia Nick. As I tell the custody officer, "You will need earplugs and high-power wards. My people will provide them. Do not speak to him Do not listen to him under any circumstances. Communicate in writing only. No more than one sentence at a time. If you've got any hearing-impaired custody officers, now would be a great time to offer them